Can't do it, because we're 100, and that's a real scramble.
Sorry about the delay.
I thought you were early.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, members of the commission, Director Unsworth. My name's Phil Anderson, and I'm here to talk to you a little bit about the Pacific Salmon Commission. I was here, I can't remember when, but a while back, and gave you an update. And we've been hard at work renegotiating the treaty since we were here last, and I wanted to have the opportunity to bring you up to date to the extent that I can on where we are and what some of the challenges are. I appreciate the work that the chairman did and the director did to get me on at the last minute here today. We had intended to come in February, but we extended our negotiating, bilateral negotiating session, and it got on top of your meeting. So this was my only opportunity, unless I waited till after that, and I wanted to get here before that. So I'm going to give you a little bit of background, some of which you've heard before, but I'm going to presume you didn't memorize it. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about our negotiating process and the issues that are up in front of the commission, and some linkages to some of the other work that's going on here in the department. So I know you all realize that we've got salmon populations that traverse the waters of both Canada and the United States during their life cycle. Salmon are subject to capture by commercial, recreational, and native fishermen in both saltwater and freshwater with a variety of jurisdictions. Pacific salmon are managed and affected by regulations of the states, the province of British Columbia, federal governments of both the United States and Canada, and the state of Alaska. The Pacific Salmon Treaty is a treaty that was organized back in 1985 between the United States and Canada. The commission administers the Pacific Salmon Treaty and provides technical advice through our regional panels and joint technical committees. The treaty covers all five species of salmon and includes the region of both Alaska, of course, Canada, Washington, and Oregon. Some of the key principles of the treaty that you'll find in the treaty itself is that each party shall conduct its fisheries and enhancement programs so as to prevent overfishing, provide for each party to receive benefits equivalent to the production of salmon originating in its waters, and in fulfilling the obligations of the treaty, the parties shall take into account the desirability, in most cases, of reducing interceptions, and the desirability in most cases to avoid undue disruption to existing fisheries. And those principles were in the original treaty that was negotiated back in 1984 and implemented in 1985, and they have stood the test of time through two additional negotiations, one in 1999 and the other one in 2008. From a structure perspective, each party has four commissioners, and each commissioner has one alternate. And then with respect to the U.S. commissioners, we each have what we call an alternate or a shadow. And in the case of myself, I'm very fortunate to have Jim Scott as my shadow. Three of the four commissioners have a vote in the U.S. section. The commissioner representing Washington, Oregon has a vote. Commissioner representing Alaska has a vote. And the commissioner representing the tribes has a vote. Interestingly, the federal commissioner does not have a vote in the U.S. section. The treaty is comprised of paragraphs that address specifics for each species that deal with management and allocation. There are panels and technical groups established by the commission, such as the Chinook Technical Committee, the Fraser Panel, the Southern Panel, and others. When we all get together, like we did last week, we number over 100 as part of the commission. And in 2 days, we drank $4,800 worth of coffee. at the Embassy Suites in downtown Portland. Each party has established a negotiating team relative to the paragraphs that I mentioned for each species, as well as lead negotiators for each party. The United States has about 16 individuals in our negotiating team, and I serve as the lead negotiator for the United States. My counterpart, Sue Farlinger, is the lead negotiator for Canada, and they also have 14 or 15 people on their negotiating team. We initially, we have four different chapters that are open for renegotiations. One is governed by the Transboundary River Panel, so we asked them to negotiate the treaty relative to that paragraph. We asked the Southern Panel to do Chum and Coho. We asked the Northern Panel to do the Northern Panel fisheries, which are basically the sockeye stocks that are coming out of Canadian rivers and being intercepted in Southeast Alaska. And then the commission itself took on the renegotiation of what we call Chapter 3, which has to do with Chinook, and that's what I'm going to spend most of my time on, given that's where most of our problems are. Hats off to especially the Transboundary Panel and Southern Panel. They've brought us work products that are nearly complete, and so that's been a tremendous help to us. I talked just a little bit about why it's important. That is the treaty. We're all well aware that a large majority of the fish, particularly coho and chinook, that originate in Washington waters, migrate north and are subject to interceptions by fisheries under the authorities in Canada and Southeast Alaska. Haven't figured out a way to put up a fence yet to keep them from going up there, and it's as they are pursuing harvesting their stocks, in particular Canada, that originate in their countries. Of course, they're catching stocks that originate in the United States. And so in the absence of having this treaty, we would have no controls in terms of the amount or numbers of interceptions that take place in Canada, or Alaska for that matter, and it would make meeting the standards of the Endangered Species Act, the challenges that we have with southern resident killer whales, much more difficult in the absence of a treaty. I'm going to give you a few numbers just to give you a sense about the differences we have with our stocks and how they're taken, where they're taken. Nooksack Spring Chinook, about 6% of the exploitation rate is taken in Southeast Alaska. About 48% is taken in Canadian fisheries, 15% in the U.S., and that leaves about 32% for escapement. So 15, 48 in Canada, and 6 in Southeast Alaska. You go down the Sound just a little ways, you can get to the Skagit. Skagit Spring, only 1% of the exploitation rate is in Southeast Alaska, 14% in Canadian waters versus the 48 that was for Nooksack, 28% in the United States, and leaving 58% for escapement. Remember, the Skagit run size is much bigger than Nooksack, so percentages can be a little deceiving, but nonetheless, if we're going to try to do something to assist Nooksack, we need help from the north. Also thought I'd just give you a couple of numbers for the upriver bright and Columbia River. That's the driver stock in the Columbia River. 13% taken in Southeast Alaska, 9% in Canada, 32% in the United States, which leaves 47% for escapement. And of course, we've had some really big run sizes of late for upriver brights, thus the large number going to escapement. Now, that is changing. Lastly, our current favorite, which is the Stillaguamish, 3% in Southeast Alaska, 26% in Canada, 19% in the U.S., and 51% to escapement. Again, remember, we're talking about a very small number of fish.
The numbers that you just gave us, is that what was negotiated, or was that reality?
That's reality.
Can you rattle off those numbers for the affiliate again, Phil, a little bit?
3% Southeast Alaska, 26% Canada, split between WCVI and Northern BC, 10% for the United States, excuse me, I'm sorry, don't write that down, 19% for the United States, and 51% escapement. I might have to put my glasses on here so I don't make a mistake. We have, I think we all have substantial conservation concerns with the Chinook that originate in our, what we're calling the Salish Sea, which includes Puget Sound, Strait of Juan de Fuca, Georgia Strait. We've had fishery exploitation rates that in some cases exceed sustainable levels, and that has contributed to driving down certain Salish Sea Chinook escapements relative to the previous 10-year agreement. So when I'm talking about the previous 10-year agreement, it's 99 through 08, and then the present 10-year goes from 09 through 18. And the other thing, we have what we call indicator stocks. Six out of the seven Pacific Salmon Treaty escapement indicator stocks are down from where they were in 2009. NOAA stated at the outset of our negotiations that a rollover of the chapter, so no change, was unlikely to meet Endangered Species Act survival and recovery standards.
May I have just a quick question?
Yeah.
Thanks, Phil, for that. You mentioned that NOAA does not have a vote. For purposes of, you know, ratifying or reaching an agreement on an annex. So even though they don't have a vote, they certainly do have input or influence on the outcome. Is that? I mean, I'm trying to.
Sure, and I'm getting. I hope I'll close that loop.
Okay. All right. Good. I think that's a question I'd like to address.
I think I'll be able to close that loop for you.
Thanks, Phil. You mentioned that there is has been over-exploitation of some stocks. Was that a result of what was negotiated, or was it due to subsequent management?
There are several stocks that we were fully cognizant would not meet their recovery exploitation rates when this treaty was negotiated and approved in 2008 and implemented in 2009. That certainly will be the case again this time around. The way that we were able to address that and get a no jeopardy opinion was through mitigation measures for those stocks, primarily associated with habitat, some with hatchery augmentation, primarily with habitat mitigation, and a thing that we called Sentinel Stocks Program.
Thank you.
Oh. Were you going to continue on?
Oh, I've got lots more. And I may get to your questions as I go, so suit yourself.
Okay, well, if you're going to get to the second one, the first one was just a repeat. Six of X stocks are down in Puget Sound?
Six of seven of the indicator stocks.
Oh, the indicator.
That the Pacific Salmon Commission uses are down.
Okay, and there's 23 some stocks entirely?
Well, there's going to be closer to 40 in the new model that we have.
And the last of those mitigation factors that you mentioned was Could you repeat that and say what
the majority of the mitigation measures had to do with habitat, but there was also a program called Sentinel Stocks Program, which was looking at research on in escapements, where particularly where we had either the, we didn't have the capacity to fully look at escapements, or there were other issues associated with things like turbidity or something that influenced the quality of the data for stocks. So I, before I was making the point that NOAA Fisheries had sent us a clear message at the Pacific Salmon Commission, and in particular the U.S. section, that a rollover of the current agreement was unlikely to meet the standards of the Endangered Species Act, such that we would get a no jeopardy opinion. And I will remind you again a little bit later that we are linked. What we do in the South in terms of addressing listed species is directly linked to what we do under the Pacific Salmon Treaty as it relates to those stocks. So there's a linkage. I wanted to just give you a sense of the magnitude of the problem. So if we look at the, if we look at in 1985, where we, the treaty was initially put in place, the terms of the treaty that was negotiated and implemented in 1985 included a 24% reduction in the exploitation rate on Puget Sound Chinook from the 79-82 base, which is the base period that was in most of our models up until recently. When the treaty was renegotiated in 1999, the stocks had continued to decline. They had been listed under the Endangered Species Act, I believe, in 1998. And there was another, there was a 60 to 65% reduction from the 79-82 base that was contained in the 99 agreement. So a big cut in the exploitation rates on Puget Sound stocks. Moving forward to the next time it was renegotiated, it was implemented in 2009, there was a 75%, it represented a 75% reduction from the 79-82 base. And my point here is that we have taken reductions, significant reductions, measured against the 79-82 base repeatedly, and we're not catching up. They're declining faster than we can catch them. And I think we're all maybe thinking to ourselves, well, this is not just a fish management problem, which is true, because on top of fish management, obviously, we have habitat degradation and we have climate change that has severely impacted the productivity of these fish. I wanted to talk just a little bit about the linkages to other applicable law and processes. And the other applicable law that I first wanted to speak to was the point that Commissioner Kehoe brought, and that is the Endangered Species Act and the role of NOAA Fisheries. They may not have a vote, but if they're telling us that the package we have will not meet the standards and get obtain a no jeopardy opinion, understanding that they have to do the analysis and so forth, they obviously have a big role to play and influence to play. They're also trustees of our tribes, and they have a significant role there to play to ensure that whatever comes out of the negotiations meets the treaty rights of the tribes in Washington, Oregon, and Idaho. There is a lawsuit. It's called Yakima Nation versus Baldrige. It's also subsequently known as the All Citizen Lawsuit. And the premise of that lawsuit was brought forward that the catches by U.S. citizens, regardless of where they occur, count against the non-treaty share. So catches of Columbia River origin fish that are headed for a usual and custom fishing area taken in the state of Alaska count against a non-Indian share. It goes on even to the point where you can think about catches south of Cape Falcon, Oregon, and places like that count against a non-treaty share. So that question was litigated, and that came out. There came out a stipulation that essentially said that while the U.S.-Canada-Pacific Salmon Treaty and this stipulation are in force, obligations of Alaska and the United States for fisheries in or adjacent to Alaska, if any, under the Stephen Palmer's treaties concerning north-south allocation of Chinook salmon shall be deemed satisfied. So we didn't have, under the terms of the stipulation, and as long as there was a Pacific Salmon Treaty, we didn't count the catches of Columbia River origin fish taken in Alaska against the non-treaty share. It goes on to say that this stipulation shall become null and void if the Pacific Salmon Treaty is terminated by either government of Canada or the United States, and this order shall be vacated by the court upon submission by any party of evidence of the termination of the treaty. So there's a, when we think about the, both from an ESA perspective and from this all citizen lawsuit perspective, this directly relates to Alaska in that they need an incidental take permit for the species that they take in the Southeast Alaska fishery that are listed as endangered or threatened under the Endangered Species Act, just like we do in Washington. And so both from a consultation perspective for ESA and relative to the all-citizen lawsuit, the Pacific Salmon Treaty is a critical component for them to continue their fisheries. I also wanted to, I didn't want to, but I'm going to, wanted to touch on the resource management plan that I think all of you are going to be talking about further tomorrow. So we, the current treaty and the chapters that I mentioned expire at the end of 2018. We have to be done with our work by the end of March, absolute deadline to get it to our respective governments to go through the approval process in Ottawa and Washington, D.C. So we started this negotiations in earnest back in November of 16. We have met, I believe I've spent 8 weeks, 5 day weeks in meetings of the U.S. section and 6 weeks, up to 8 day sessions in bilaterals, putting this package together. To the best of my knowledge, the Department of Fish and Wildlife and the tribes began developing a resource management plan, at least in part, for purposes of gaining coverage for through an incidental take permit for the fisheries, for both state and tribal fisheries, I believe somewhere in the July time frame. There is a immediate need for us to make sure that we understand what is in the U.S. proposal as it pertains to particularly Puget Sound Chinook, and what is in the resource management plan as it pertains to Puget Sound Chinook. Because remember that we are coming at this that status quo is not an option, that we need further reductions in takes under the purview of the Pacific Salmon Treaty. And my understanding of the new recovery exploitation rates that are part and parcel to your negotiations in developing the resource management plan are also looking at potential reductions to meet the requirements of the Endangered Species Act, get a no jeopardy opinion, and an incidental take permit. it is imperative, I think I said that already, for us to collaborate and coordinate those efforts so that we aren't duplicative and that we are complementary. And at least for my part, I have talked with Ron Warren here just this afternoon, talked to Director Unsworth, with Jim Scott, and I actually had a conversation with Mr. Grossman here earlier today, and we are going to endeavor to make sure that happens in the near term. I want to just touch on the objectives that we are trying to achieve through our renegotiations. We want to use more recent data and a larger number of indicator stocks to ensure the best management practices possible. We have the opportunity to do that through the development of a new model that's been under development for about a year and a half and isn't quite ready to go yet, but hopefully within the next 2 weeks it will. We want to implement new accountability measures for both countries to ensure that the actions that they are taking are consistent with the obligations that they agree to under the terms of the treaty. We want to seek funds for a 10-year program to improve stock assessments through improvements to our coded wire tags, both in terms of numbers, increase the number of double index tags, and catch and escapement improvements via objective and repeatable methodologies for data-limited situations. We're also proposing a fund to help us improve data collection relative to marked selective fisheries. And there will be an important funding component of likely coming from this treaty that will include mitigation measures, in particular for those stocks that are not expected to meet their recovery exploitation rates, either through the actions taken by the Commission in implementing the treaty and in combination with the actions taken by the state and tribes in implementing the resource management plan. We're looking at new methodologies for determining the catch ceiling for Southeast Alaska fisheries. We're looking for some clear and specific limitations on incidental mortalities, along with accountability measures for those. And finally, and maybe the most important, is our new agreement must be responsive to the serious and precipitous decline in Chinook productivity and management strategies that fail to meet our conservation objectives. There may be some questions in your minds relative to what we're talking about in terms of allocation and or how we are proposing to address conservation concerns. And at this time, in deference to the confidentiality protocols that are in place from the United States State Department and our agreement with Canada, I'm not at liberty to disclose the specific details being discussed. But I can say that we are very mindful and focused on seeking changes that complement and or additive to those taken by the state and tribes. I will talk about those specifics when I engage with Ron Warren, Jim Scott, Director Unsworth, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, specifics. What is it? The devil is in the details is certainly applicable to this situation, and we'll be having very candid conversations about that. I'm also happy to talk with any of you individually, by phone or in person, and with some to address some of those specific questions you may have about it. And I'm also working with Jim to put together kind of a round table of stakeholders, just a kind of an open invitation to come to a meeting, presumably at the department, where I can talk about some of the provisions. So, because this is going to be a surprise, and people don't like surprises. So the extent that we can keep the entire package from being a surprise, we're going to endeavor to do that. I'm sorry. Thank you. I have just one other piece that I wanted to share, especially if I can find it. I talked a little bit about funding, and I have no doubt in order to get an agreement that that a substantial investment of federal funding will be needed. It's happened in each one of our last two agreements. We had Canadian fishery mitigation in 2009. That may be a part of the package again. We had mitigation associated with Southeast Alaska fisheries and the reductions there. It's time for me to stop. And we also had habitat improvements and hatchery conservation programs as part of the mitigation package. They're coming at me, actually. So it's going to be really important, and I talked to Jeff Davis, talked to Jim Scott, talked to Ron Warren about making sure we understand exactly what the expenses are for participating in the treaty from the department. The improvements to stock assessments, code aware tag program that I talked about, as well as the additional conservation measures associated with habitat and hatchery conservation programs. So I'm going to stop there, whether I want to or not, and I'll try to answer any questions you might have.
Thanks, Bill. Alarmingly informative.
Phil, could you talk a little bit about what the approval process is? And then I can't help but ask a political question. I understand we're in like five trade wars right now with Canada. Is there a political issue here of concern in terms of the approval process? And then just an observation in terms of thinking about the funding. One of the things that I'm struck with is we're so often the terminal fishery, and it seems that it's the terminal fisheries that are really stuck with the conservation responsibilities. And I think I've been really struck by that. I think it's sometimes really hard for our stakeholder. It doesn't seem fair. You know, when you're working with the environment, it isn't totally fair in terms of allocation, but you know, as you have the public discussions, I think that's really something to think about. But my question's about the politics.
Well, there were three points there. One is the approval process. If everything goes smoothly, never does, but let's say it does, we get an agreement on all the aspects, and we get chapter language developed with Canadians. We get that done by the end of March, send those off to our respective governing bodies, in particular for us, the State Department. We're compliant with all the applicable law. There will be a consultation undertaken from an ESA perspective. It will integrate what is happening in Washington also. I don't claim to understand entirely what the Canadians go through, but it's a significant... They're really nervous about being able to get it approved in the time that we have. One of the things that we're doing to try to expedite that is as we get to agreements on specific parts, we're putting it in our vault, because at the end of the day, it has to be in a package in its entirety. No single part gets approved until the whole package is done. But we are allowing our respective legal reviews in Canada and the United States of those pieces so that we don't have to wait till it's all done to begin that review to help expedite the review process. If there are monetary implications, commitments, then we have the whole congressional process to go through to get those funds authorized and appropriated. So it's a significant, we did that, we had that last time too. But I think in this environment it may be more difficult. In terms of connections with trade agreements, I'm not aware, and it has been not, it hasn't been brought to my attention that there is a concern there at this point in our really dynamic political environment that we seem to be living in today. That could probably change tomorrow with a tweet. Sorry. And we have several other treaties. We have an Albacore treaty. We have a Whiting treaty. We have a Halibut treaty. So I'm not anticipating that on the political side. The last piece on, I know this is really, really tough for people to, I don't know about understand, but accept certainly, is you've got these stocks, and some of them are largely, there's a significant portion of them being taken in Canada, and why can't you guys stop them from doing that? You know? Just tell them you're not going to do it. Well, what happens if we don't have a treaty at all? We have no way to put any limitations on at all. And if the situation were reversed, and their stocks, which it is in some cases, like in Southeast Alaska, and their stocks are coming into our waters, here we are harvesting our fish that originate in our waters, and by doing so, we're creating a conservation issue for them. They, you know, so up to this point, and particularly when you think about the level of reductions that have taken place since we started back in 79-82, the Canadians have been pretty responsive to us. It hasn't been for free, and believe me, there won't be anything free here, either monetarily or they're looking for reductions of Canadian origin stocks that are taken in Southeast Alaska. They're not going to go, oh yeah, we'll help you, but we're not going to worry about you helping us. So all of those pieces are in play here. But one of the ways I often go back and think about it is Washington better off with the treaty as it, you know, as we have negotiated it and are ready and are considering saying yes to, versus not having a treaty, not having ESA coverage, not having being put in a place where all the conservation burden does fall back on the state, because we don't have any willingness to reduce fisheries to the north to help us with those stocks of concern. At the end, you know, sooner or later, you come to that point where you have to make that decision. And I assume you're going to be doing the same thing with your RMP?
Yeah, I think that's the really important point. Thanks.
Yeah,
Gerber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks, Phil. Speaking of the RMP, and you brought it up, the treaty negotiations, you're supposed to come to an agreement end of March, right? So the RMP, on the other hand, is you know, more of a long-term process, needs to be approved, you know, go through the federal process. So can you speak a little bit, though, about how those two integrate? I mean, I think you touched on it a little bit more, but so is it important then for the negotiators to get, you know, maybe not know the fine details, but have a basic kind of roadmap of what an RMP may look like? Maybe talk a little bit more about that, flesh that out, if you can.
I'll try. You're correct, from my understanding, that the RMP and the approval process and the review process is going to extend beyond, or maybe even be going on simultaneous to an evaluation of the treaty, but certainly in different forms. But some, there'll be some commonality there too in terms of the NOAA review, right? So right now, in our current chapter, I'm speaking to Chinook. I want to do deference to Fraser Sockeye. So
that's coming up.
Yeah. We last time around we agreed. There's a thing called a general obligation, and for stocks that are not meeting their escapement goal, we agreed to reduce to restrict our impacts to 60% of the 79-82 base period from 09 through 2018. So so we every year when we go through the North Valley process and everything, we look at those stocks and we make sure that the impacts in the U.S. fisheries don't exceed 60% of the value of the 79-82 time frame. So regardless of what goes on in North of Falcon or in our domestic process, we already have a restriction in place and an obligation pursuant to the treaty that we, the United States, entered into with Canada. In some cases in our RMP that we've had in the past, we have the recovery exploitation rate. I mean, pick a number. Stock X has a recovery exploitation rate of 30%. And through the negotiations of our RMP, we also have a restriction on southern U.S. fisheries. So, again, pick a number. We're not going to have more than 10% exploitation rate in southern U.S. fisheries. The RAR is 30%. We've made a commitment through the treaty to restrict our fisheries to no more than 60% of the 79-82 base. We have this additional feature in an RMP that further that restricts southern U.S. fisheries to an amount. Well, if there isn't coordination between the two, and we agree to an obligation in the treaty, I mean, let's say to address our current situation, we're going to say we're only going to take 20% of the 79-82 base. In other words, an 80% reduction. And at the same time, our folks are over here negotiating an RMP that has the same RER, in this case, third example, 30%. But through their negotiations, they're also, as part of their agreement with the tribes, putting in place a southern U.S. restriction, further a subset of the RER. Or maybe they do a pre-terminal and terminal area separation. Well, if you're not coordinated, you can end up with a more restrictive regime than what you intended. That make sense?
Yes, it does.
Okay, so instead of being the general obligation being whatever it is, the general obligation is X. It's in the treaty. We're going to limit our fisheries to no more than 60% of the 79-82 base. But in this realm that we're in, because of the low productivity and other, we're going to take another step. And Canada is looking at us saying, well, if you're going to ask us to further reduce our interceptions on your fisheries, what are you doing? What additional things are you doing? Okay. So instead of that 60% of the 79-82 base, they're going, we're willing to help you out here, but we're expecting you to take some additional restrictions on your side of the border, too. In the meantime... We've got another process going on relative to the RMP between the state and the tribes that may be further delineating restrictions with our domestic, within our domestic fisheries. If they're not linked up and there's not some coordination there, you can have an outcome that's not intended. And that's, I don't know if I made it so confusing that nobody understood what I was saying.
Well, I think, so we negotiate with the tribes. The tribes are also part of the treaty. It would seem important that the same kind of coordination is going on with the treaty, the tribal representatives on the treaty team and the tribes who we're negotiating with.
So Ron Allen is the commissioner representing the tribes, and his alternate is McCoy Oatman from the Nez Perce tribe. At our recent meeting, which involved more than the negotiations, I would guess we had 80 tribal members there, representatives there. So there's a lot of presence in the Pacific Salmon Commission Forum of the tribes. And within our negotiating team, in addition to Ron Allen, we have Craig Bohe from Northwest Indian Fisheries Commission, who's a leader in the RMP, I believe. And we also have Lorraine Loomis. So there is crossover there and coordination there. All I can speak to is who's there. To the degree that they coordinate, I'm not sure, but I presume that they do. The important thing on our end is that we're doing the same thing. And because the development of the RMP has been under the jurisdiction or of the court, they haven't been able to talk to me. Your guys haven't been able to talk to me. So I don't know what you got, you know, I don't know what's going on in there. So I do now. It's out. It, you know, was made public and all. I know what's in it now, but I didn't know what was in it before.
Thanks, Phil.
Which is upped my angst about coordination and why Rod and I are getting together here soon.
So we can call on you?
Absolutely.
Appreciate that.
Thanks for the time. I'm sorry to draw your day out.
Thank you, Phil. Briefing. And with that, hearing no other points, we will adjourn until tomorrow morning at 8:30.